Good afternoon, folks. This is Seraphine Hurley, and you are listening to Infinite Inquisition. And yes, we are live. It is October 7th, and we're going to be talking about the Egyptian Book of the Dead and curses, the mummy's curses. And so with this information that I have, is some of you are just getting to know me, some of you have known me for a while. I actually write out all of my stuff, and that's why you're probably not seeing me if you're looking for me on YouTube right at the moment. I will be available on YouTube once I get my place unpacked. I promise, because I've got my master computer staring right at me, but I've got like three boxes, gigantic boxes worth of stuff, and two keyboard stands in my way. I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to put all this stuff in my office. So with that, I would like to thank you for your listenership, and please remember to like, share, and subscribe the show. If you do have any show ideas or anything of the sort, to please go ahead and contact me. All of my social media is Seraphine Hurley, Twitter, Seraphine1818 at Twitter, and Instagram is Seraphine Hurley as well. So you can contact me any of those places. Happy to field your questions, and so I don't know how your day's been going, but I was getting ready for my show, and you know, I do pre-show stuff like try to warm up my voice a little bit for you and have some water or take a shower and, you know, relax a little bit so I don't get ahead of myself. And all of a sudden I hear, it sounds like somebody's talking in my living room, and I just got out of the shower and I'm like, what? I never put my clothes on so fast in my entire life. I'm looking down the hallway, and legitimately, I just literally came out of the shower, and there's three maintenance guys, three, coming out of the alcove, my front door where my elevator is, because I have a personal elevator, and they come out, and this two dudes are sticking their heads out. One guy is already in my living room measuring. And he's measuring the windows. Well, I didn't get a 24-hour slip. The slip said I got it on Saturday night under my door. They ninja'd it. And the slip, if I showed y'all what it actually looks like, the slip actually states that I need to make a phone call to the company that's doing the estimate on the windows for Hurricane Irma damage, and that I need to make that phone call to make an appointment for my convenience, not a 24-hour notice. So obviously, because otherwise I wouldn't have been wet, naked, and standing there shocked. So, I mean, I'm standing there. Once I got up to the front, I realized that my shirt was on backwards. Oh my gosh, it's only funny now. I'm still annoyed. I guess I gotta calm down before I call the front office and tell them that, you know, you need to check your paperwork, because oh my gosh. But so your Seraphine guys got a little bit of a scare and an aggravation before I came on. Oh my gosh. But sorry for the lateness with the technical issues and the lovely interruption with the people in my front room. But so the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which has gotten a lot of press in the last, I would say, I don't know, good 45, 6 years, on and off. It was been mentioned in horror movies. It's been mentioned and referred to as the next Necronomicon, which actually is an H.P. Lovecraft thing. And but a lot of people get it confused. And the Book of the Dead is actually not just a singular piece. It's many, many pieces that make up a whole piece. But then there's more sections that actually make it up, because they're made up by what is referred to as the Cult of the Dead. And what the Cult of the Dead actually is all of the priests, high priestesses, and sages, mages, and lay people that make up the people that come and take care of you when you pass away, from the highest of the elite to the lowest of the low. So, because even people who were not highborn got burials as well. So it's kind of interesting, all of this. I've been researching this for years, but this is just the stuff I'm going to give you guys today. So on with our talking of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. So the Book of the Dead is actually a papyrus. made by very, very highly skilled scribes. Now, not all scribes are that highly skilled. So some of you guys are into Egyptology or archaeology, things like that, or even antique papers, you know that not all papyruses are very highly skilled marked or anything. You'd had to be really, really regarded to be able to deal in this kind of papyrus. And usually more than one scribe actually worked on one of these books of the dead for the individual who they're talking about. And it's like a super obit with spells in it. Isn't that kind of interesting? I thought that it was interesting. So sometimes on the papyruses themselves, the spaces were left for additional artists like the family would add or other people to add images and or imprints into that book. That would be something that would either please the gods better and give them a higher chance of passing over into the afterlife, or something that would please the dead person, be it that they felt like if you were a powerful person, you were going to be just as powerful or more powerful in death. Isn't that interesting? So more ahead, excuse me. The finest book of the dead papyruses were actually read, or papyri, which are the is the actual terminological, whatever, technical term, we should say, were written to order. So some were made ahead and with blank spaces left for that individual purchaser's name, or if you wanted to copy. Like Lemmy down the street, say, Lemmy had a really awesome burial and I really loved his papyrus. And so I want to copy Lemmy. So you would hire a scribe or try to get the same scribe that did that one and then add your name to it, even though some of the details would be changed, of course, because you're not Lemmy. It's not everybody can be Lemmy, right? Thousands of the book of thing and helping to form and try to produce long-term preservation styles so that we can keep them from falling apart. Because I've actually seen some of these in museums and actually been in the room with a couple of them and been able to see it up close and personal. And just the slightest tap will get it to flake, just the tiniest bit. They're so super fragile. And they're just amazing to see. So if you haven't seen one, please do. They're amazing to look at. Just the artwork alone, even if you're looking at it through glass, is amazing. So, but new imaging technologies, and it's super hard also to find imaging technologies that they can actually use because some X-rays are actually pretty harmful to these little guys. So, and you can't really copy them. So, in these, very personal to the person. But these imaging technologies are revealing hidden or papyrus or books of the dead are actually different museum are revealing now previously unsuspected links between separate fragments. Now, the original Book of the Dead made by Neston Shabiru, which I don't speak ancient Egyptian, so you can laugh all you want. I'm not even going to pretend that I can say that perfectly. Who actually died around 930 BC. This Book of the Dead is actually, I croaked when I, it's about 398 square feet long. And that's a lot of papyrus. And is the longest known example. Contains a very, very large collection of spells written in a precise hieratic hand and illustrated with exceptionally fine line drawings. Besides the traditional spells that are in many other books of the dead, which are not found in other manuscripts and which may have been included by this person's personal request. Now, this person was actually the daughter of Pynjum the Second, who was the high priest of Amun at a great religious center of Thebes. Well, here's Thebes because people, everybody knows Thebes, right? Because they saw the mummy, right? and a virtual ruler of Upper Egypt. She was one of the most powerful women of her time and was buried in a royal cache at Delawari, the family tomb of the high priest, which also became the last resting place of the greatest pharaohs of the New Kingdom. Now, today, the papyrus is also known as the Greenfield Papyrus after Edith May Greenfield, who donated it to the British Museum where I saw it. She donated that in 1910. So ancient Egyptians believed that the cosmos consisted of the earth, the sky, and the netherworld. They saw the movement of the sun, moon, and stars, the annual flooding of the Nile, and the growth of the plants as an evidence of an eternal cycle of life, and believed that human existence could be renewed as a part of this cycle. In eternal life, Egyptians hoped to travel to the sky and nether worlds inhabited by the gods, and revisit the world of the living. The perfect afterlife was a perfect vision of the Egypt that they had lived in, where they would have been reunited with their families to attain eternal life. Their body had to be preserved, and the spirit aspects of the person, the ka and ba, had to be sustained. The ancient Egyptians held a complex set of beliefs about their afterlife. Very, very complex set of beliefs. One ancient source which helps us to understand what they really thought would happen after death is the collection of texts known today as the Books of the Dead. Now, this brings together examples of what we're talking about now, and mainly, well, you might as well say between Old Kingdom and New Kingdom period, between about 1550 and 1069 BC. Papyrus format and associated objects, which explore both the ancient Egyptian beliefs and the evolution and manufacture of the text itself. The Book of the Dead was a collection of illustrations and of spells written on, as I said before, a papyrus roll, a traditional papyrus roll. Now, it was put inside a hollow statue or sometimes wrapped in with the mummy wrappings, excuse me, and placed in the tomb with all the other things which the dead person would need for the afterlife. Now, why did the ancient Egyptian person need that Book of the Dead in their tomb? The ancient Egyptians believed that the natural world of people and the supernatural world of the gods were closely interwoven. Magic and ritual were part of religious practices used to overcome the challenges of everyday life, such as childbirth, sickness, or injury. Now, magic was also used to enable the dead to reach the afterlife. It was invoked by pronouncing spells and performing special actions. The Book of the Dead was a collection of about 200 spells that helped the dead person to successfully face the dangers and the tests of the gods in the netherworld and before, and to achieve eternal life. Now, a typical Book of the Dead scroll would contain only a selection of these spells that were just basically for that person, selected for them specifically, what their needs really were, to meet them where they were, so to speak. The Egyptian name for this collection was the Book of Coming Forth by Day. The spells and illustrations in the Book of the Dead gave a dead person the knowledge and the power they needed to journey safely through the dangers of the netherworld, a place the dead went immediately after death. They also spoke of the ultimate goal of every ancient Egyptian, What do you think that goal was? Just like the vampires, eternal life. So, what other information would be included in the Book of the Dead, you might think? Because I asked myself that question. So, I figured maybe you all are thinking, well, what else would be in store for that? Well, the Book of the Dead told the dead person, or the recently deceased, the recently deceased handbook, kind of like in Beetlejuice. Most of us saw that movie, right? If you haven't seen it, you should see it because it's cute. So, telling the dead about the landscape of the netherworld, which they would really journey through as recently deceased people, the gods and the hostile creatures that they could possibly meet up with, and the ever so critical weighing of your heart judgment to decide if the dead person, or recently deceased, however you prefer it, was allowed into the afterlife. So, now, more importantly, was when you died, you were given a special, you only had so many days before you could be buried, and all of these things would have to transpire immediately after you died. And then it was a rush, 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 make sure that this person gets to where they're going, because you don't want to miss the recently deceased train, because you want to make sure that you get your heart weighed and you get the keys to the afterlife. You want to get to that party in the netherworld, right? So the day of the burial was when the dead person was thought to move from the world of the living here on earth to the world of the dead. The Book of the Dead shows that the ceremonies that took place at the funeral of most wealthy Egyptians, this included the vital opening of the mouth ceremony. When the priest touched the mouth and the eyes of the mummy with the ritual tools so that it could see and that it could breathe, thus symbolically bringing it back to life. Now, ancient Egyptians also believed in preserving the body after death for the purposes of a happy afterlife. So, we're going to talk about funerary practices, including mummification. Don't worry, I'm not going to get gross on you kids, as much as I would love to, because but I know a lot of you are like me, or have a weak stomach. So I will respect that regard. So, but according to lore, we're going to move on with our preservation of the dead history, since most people don't really want to talk about how they'd take a hook and take your brains out through your nose. According to the lore, Osiris, who, as we know, is an Egyptian god, pretty major one, was dismembered. Isis, his wife, saw to it that his body parts were rejoined and that he was revived. The Egyptians believed this myth about resurrection and copied the ritual of preserving the body from the sixth dynasty. Sixth. Okay, this happened for a really seriously long time. So from the sixth dynasty until the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, only the bodies of aristocrats such as pharaohs were carefully preserved. However, during later periods, ordinary Egyptians also turned to preservation of their dead if they could afford it. The rituals associated with preservation practices became symbolic representations of Egyptian culture and influenced the future of burial preparations around the world. Now, as lower middle class burials, the I'm not going to say dirt poor, but poor people who could not afford a Michael Jackson style funeral, because who can afford that kind of thing? Poor Egyptians could not afford extravagant burials. I mean, yeah, I just came in from digging a ditch and making a papyrus, or hanging out with the high priestess and brushing her hair. I don't think I can afford to do this, so I can only imagine. trying to afford an extravagant burial on a pittance. The process of embalming involved the washing of intestines, followed by the placing of a body in a natron, basically a divine salt bath for 70 days. Next, the viscera, or it, I'm trying to say this nicely, internal organs were removed, wrapped in linen, and placed in canopic jars. How very gothic. The heart, then, the only organ left inside, kind of like a Build-A-Bear. Now, they left it inside the body because it was thought that it contained your soul. It contained the soul of the dead person. So, even though it was believed that even the poorest individuals should have the burial to protect the living from a ghost rising from the soul, so they kept the heart intact, unless you were being punished for some reason, and then they would tear your heart apart. And that's something for another talk about, macabre things here on Infinite Inquisition, but we're talking about their burials right now. But having a ghost rising from the soul because the person didn't have this or that or whatever, because they believe that even your soul could be tortured for eternity if they wanted to, if you were extra special naughty. So next, the body would be lying on its or positioned to its left side into a fetal position facing west, and then placed into a shallow pit. The family members would then recite prayers of placing flowers and would visit these humble graves to mourn their loss. Now, middle class Egyptians, blue collar Egyptians, endured another type of embalming that also used natron, which is, once again, it's a hardcore salt bath for 70 days. A professional embalmer injected oil of cedar into the body's anus, where it was physically contained for a specific time period. Then the natron was applied to the body for curing until the cedar oil drained away. Talk about seepage, man. As a result of this powerful process, the viscera dissolved completely, and the embalmer returned the flesh and the bones of the preserved body to the families. The bodies of the well-to-do Egyptians were often wrapped in grass or reed mats, and they were buried in coffins or baskets. Elaborate burial goods, such as jewelry, were placed inside these coffins. Now, the burying of the elite. And we talk about that. The process of mummification, which involved drying out the corpse and preparing it for preservation, as always used for the burials of the elite Egyptians, such as queens and kings and princes and so on and so forth. Natron having desiccating and unfatting defatting characteristics was the essential ingredient in mummification. It was also very cheap. It was easy for them to do. So the first step, like we said before, and I was jesting, but I was truly, truly sincere when I said it, was to take the deceased elite was brain removal, which involved using an iron hook to remove the organ through the nose. Then, with a knife, the embalmer would cut open the abdomen and remove all viscera carefully. Then, the embalmer would wash out the abdominal cavity with wine and spices, and then filled it with myrrh, cassia, and other aromatic substances. So, it'd be like going to Bed Bath and Beyond. And, like, yeah, just eviscerate me and potpourri me. Sew me back up. Woohoo! Yeah, I don't need to be embalmed. Just soak me in some salt water and stuff me with potpourri. Awesome. So, excuse me. Finally, the embalmer sewed up the cavity excuse me, placed the body in natron and waited for the 70 days before washing the body again and wrapping it in linen smeared with gum. The family then received the mummy, which was placed into a wooden coffin or sarcophagus with the shape of human form, usually. Not all the time, but usually. So for most purposes, that Egyptian sarcophagus, not all of them were called sarcophaguses, just so that we get that straight, but for the most part, they were. And its construction was based on both symbolic and practical terms for corpse protection. Not projection, protection. Or protraction? No, protection. We're trying to protect the corpse, not take measurements or expel it from where it's at. Early tombs were made from mud and brick and were called mastabas. The term mastaba is based on the Arabic word for bench. So corpses laid inside the rectangular mastabas often rotted away in the cool moisture of their interiors, creating a problem for visiting family members. Can you imagine going to your cousin's gravesite and like being downwind? Well, that'd be problematic. So, but why would we choose to do mummification now if you really think about it? Because the day of the burial marked that transition of the dead person from the world of the living to that of the dead, and the mummified person being taken to the tomb accompanied by members of the family, the mourners and the servants bringing grave goods. Outside the tomb, the opening of the mouth ceremony was performed to symbolically bring that body back to life so that it could be reunited with the spirit. The mummy then placed inside its sarcophagus or coffin and sealed inside its burial chamber, if you could afford one. It was never to be seen again until archaeologists start digging them up. But the relationship between the living and the dead went on. The relatives of the deceased maintained a cult at the tomb, sustaining the Ka spirit with the regular gifts of food and drink, while the dead person traveled as a spirit, Ba, the Ka and the Ba, through the netherworld, they preserved body. So the mummy, being preserved as a mummy, remained in the tomb, but they would still offer alcohol and food. And it's like, hey, Aunt Mary, I'm going to KFC. Do you want something? So, okay, I'll just bring something back and just have a picnic and, you know, give her some diet soda and some chicken nuggets or something, hang out. But they kept doing that to honor the dead and keep the spirit appeased. So the mummy had to be kept safe so that all of their spirit and their body could be ready to partake of their perfect afterlife. So the tomb comprised a chapel for the cult of the dead and the sealed burial chamber for the mummy. So the cult of the dead being the people who would come to see to the body, to pray, to lament, to mourn, or to just spend time. Now, the mummified body was crucial as the physical base to which the person's spirit would return. Although the body had been preserved by mummification, it is still quite vulnerable to attack by hostile forces. The mummy was protected from these with those written spells we talked about earlier that were written in the Book of the Dead that was attached either somewhere within the sarcophagus with the mummy itself or in one of the decorative urns or statues. Even small amulets or charms were placed on and under the wrappings of the mummy, giving the dead person a range of powers and protection. Spells in the Book of the Dead describe these powers given to the deceased. So, if you were to give Aunt Mary a necklace or you were to give her something that was literally charged up with some kind of power, you would have written it somewhere and left it on the body so that Aunt Mary could read it or just know that she knew how to use that amulet or that necklace or whatever you gave. So it would be for protection or whatever it was for. Many spells in the Book of the Dead gave the dead person power to control the elements of their personality and the forces of nature. Spells prevented the decay of the body and the loss of the most essential parts, the head, like the location and identity and senses, and the heart, the location of the mind. Other spells sustained the non-physical parts of the person, the shadow, name, and the ka. And ba spirits, some of the spells enabled the dead person to breathe, drink, control fire, freely move and travel in the sun god's boat. One of the most important set of texts were transformation spells, allowing the dead person to turn into different forms, such as a falcon, a heron, a swallow, a lotus flower, a snake, or a crocodile. These forms gave the deceased free movement and special divine powers. Now, you may be asking yourself, what was Netherworld like? Well, the deceased in spirit form had to journey through the world of the dead now, right? So the Netherworld was thought to be beneath the earth. Occasionally, it was considered to be in the sky, known as the Duat. Now, it was regarded as a mysterious place and was never mapped or described in a consistent manner at all. No consistency at all, just hither skither. So, the dead person could travel on foot, by boat, or through the air in different physical forms. The Book of the Dead contained information about features and beings in the Netherworld, including gateways, caverns, and mounds, how they would be watched over by strange gods that they didn't have any idea of, or how to pacify these strange gods that they weren't sure of when they were alive. Safe passage could only be guaranteed with this kind of sacred knowledge within the containment of the spells that were on the person. So hopefully you thought ahead of time to write all this stuff out for your Aunt Mary so that she could counter anything that those strange gods or creatures had in mind. The dead person traveled through that landscape with the paths, rivers, mountains, caves, lakes and fields. On this journey, they went through many gates and doors, which were guarded by gods. What do you do when somebody asks you if you're a god? All right. Hopefully, you know the answer to that question. You might be asked, what use were the spells given in the Book of the Dead? Well, like I said, some spells gave the dead person the power to control their body and keep it safe. Some spells allowed the dead person to turn into different animals, making it easier to travel through the Netherworld. Some spells gave the dead person information, which they would need to repeat at certain points on their journey. Some spells gave the dead person protection against hostile creatures. Now, the Egyptians envisioned the Netherworld as a place of many dangers. Many spells in the Book of the Dead gave the dead person the power to drive away snakes, crocodiles, and insects. Others kept them safe from physical harm. Deities armed with snakes and knives ensured the dead person's safety. They also guarded the homes of the living and watched over the dead in their tombs. One spell mentioned in the Book of the Dead describes gods who could repel enemies. Protective gods were painted on coffins and statues, and the statues of them could be placed around the mummy to create a cordon of safety, kind of like the velvet rope, but kind of not. Give yourself a VIP of safety. Now, judgment. The greatest test which the dead person faced was the judgment in the Hall of the Two Truths. Here, the gods reviewed the dead person's behavior during their life to decide whether or not they deserve to enter the afterlife. First, the dead person addressed 42 deities by name, declaring to each that they were innocent of a specific offense, such as, let's say, theft, telling lies, stealing a cookie from Aunt Mary's cookie jar. The ancient Egyptians believed that the heart was the center. Like we said before, the heart is your center of a person's being, your soul, your mind, everything that you are contained in the heart is what they believed. So the center of your being and the location. So the thing is that the dead person's heart was weighed against an image of Maat, not of a mat, of Maat, the goddess Maat, the embodiment of order, right, and truth. The heart could speak, and so spells ensured that it did not reveal any damning facts about its owner. So that heart was ride or die. Just make sure that that spell is rock solid so that it's not going to give you up. So gotta rely on those ancestors to keep up with all of your information and clear your heart's browser history. Toot sweet, right? So your heart not revealing any damning facts about your owner, a perfect balance indicated a life well spent. So the god Thoth returned the heart to its owner and declared them true of voice before they were welcomed to paradise by the god Osiris. Now, if the heart was heavier than Maat, its owner was condemned, their heart eaten by the monstrous devourer, and their existence ended. All copies of the Book of the Dead show a successful outcome. Isn't that, it's kind of like a white lighter copy. Like, yeah, nothing bad ever happens here. It's like, you gotta watch out for that thing that might eat you and kill you and make you not live at all ever again. But 'cause that devour thing, just pay it no mind. But however, you're gonna have a great afterlife no matter what, even if you stole that cookie. 'Cause you can't help it. Aunt Mary makes some great cookies. So, gotta watch out for that devourer. Different versions of the Book of the Dead contain different ideas about the afterlife. One view was that the mummy would remain resting in the tomb in the underworld realm of Osiris. In contrast, the boss spirit had the freedom to leave the body each day. The spirit could revisit the world of the living or travel with the sun god Ra and his boat. That would be cool. Be on Ra's yacht sailing around the sun, the sun boat. That'd be awesome. Can you imagine it? I can. This meant that the dead could share Ra's rebirth each dawn and return to the tomb each night. Another view was that the dead person would exist in a place of paradise, the field of reeds. This was depicted in the Book of the Dead as a perfect Egypt, lush, plush, luxurious, Well watered, fertile, with abundant crops, this was a perfect version of Egypt, and it is described in the Book of the Dead as the most desirable option, because why would you want to be in your own personal VIP when you could hang out in the reeds and go fishing every day, I guess. I don't know, be on a barge being rowed across the river. I don't know, it's your afterlife. You make it up. So, the gods judged how the newly and recently deceased person had led their life to decide if they deserve to be given eternal life and to enter an afterlife. You got that? The dead person's heart was weighed on a set of scales against the feather of truth. If the scales showed the dead person was free from evil, then they were declared true of voice and admitted to the afterlife. If not, their heart would be eaten by that devourer, like we said before, even though all of the outcomes really show that nobody has been eaten by the devourer. But that's not entirely true, because I've seen papyruses for the bad outcome. So is that just a sample of, or like a writer's sample, saying that this could happen potentially, but don't let it happen to you? Right? So, because if that devourer monster comes out, you would cease to exist forever. Like your name would be wiped out. You would be nothing anymore. And you'd be less than nothing. Like you never existed. But if you passed over, the perfect afterlife could be different for different people. The dead person might join the gods, worshiping Osiris or traveling with the sun god, or they might enter a pastoral paradise in that field of reeds, that landscape like Egypt with the waterways to sail on, the fields with crops to ensure that the dead never went hungry. Because you don't want to not feed the dead, because then they're going to run around trying to eat brains and stuff. Nobody wants that. The CDC has a contingency for that. So, why and how was the Book of the Dead made? Scribes and painters wrote out and illustrated the Book of the Dead papyrus roll. Sometimes most of the roll was already written, like I said previously, and the tomb owner just had to write their own name and have a picture added in. The Book of the Dead used and was used for over 1500 years. And actually, there's more things pointing now that I've researched that it's more than 1500 years, but the more solid answer is 1500. But I would go with longer because of the stuff that I've actually seen. But we all know that I'm weird, and that's why you love me. So this being a part of a tradition of proving religious texts for the dead, The earliest of these texts are found in the Old Kingdom, about 2686 to 2181 BC. Pyramids, and they were intended for dead kings. Over time, texts for the dead became available to other members for the royal family, nobles, and middle classes. The first texts were actually written on tomb walls, like you'd see in Indiana Jones, if you've never seen the interior of a tomb, if you weren't able to see the King Tut exhibit, things like that. But that's basically what they did. It was written on the tomb walls. But the more important stuff was usually written and put on the body itself. Later, from about 2050, and these are loosely calculated by me, so if they're wrong, it's my fault. 2050 to 1750 BC, they were carved onto coffins, so or sarcophagi. So the Book of the Dead developed from these coffin texts and have been found on coffins, shroud, papyrus, and bandages. So actually, I saw this really funky mummy when I was in Egypt, and this Egypt had what it looked like spells written all along the linen cloth, every wrapping. It's like every time they went around, there was another it was like a story and a spell and a something about the person and another spell, and then there was it wasn't exactly hither skither or anything, but there was some kind of, but there were, it was like protection and spells and blah, blah, blah. It was really interesting. It looked like something from a video game. So that's where video games get it. Is that this stuff actually happened? People actually see mummies, and if you can find one that's well enough preserved, because a lot of times they find the mummies and they're so badly decayed that the writings and stuff don't go with them. And so you don't get to see the really interesting part that their body was inscribed, well, not their body, but their linens, their cloaking or wrappings were written on. And then for the most part, when they're so decayed because it's been such a long time, or the tomb has been flooded, or it's flooded because somebody decided to rob the tomb, which is unfortunate, all of that stuff goes bye-bye and we lose all that information. So grave robbery, bad, 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 bad. So, excuse me. So the most elaborate books of the dead were actually made mostly during the New Kingdom period, about 1550 to 1069, but it finally stopped being used as a funerary text in the 1st century BC. Now, what do we do with the books of the dead today? So today, people study the Book of the Dead and they reconstruct fragments of papyrus so that they can read them. And sometimes they can discover pieces from the same papyrus roll in different museums in different places from around that whole area. Like, it's not like it stopped one place and went on in another. It's like the same scribe used the similar markings to put something together, and it's like a long rolling spell that goes over several miles. It's really interesting. So it gives scholars and people that work in the museums new information. They work out what the ancient Egyptians might have thought or might have thought happened to a person when they died. Conservation teams look after these objects and really, like I said, they're really trying to conserve and preserve everything that they can now, because we've lost so much, either through theft or natural disaster or other things. It's really kind of sad. And I know people think this is pretty grim, but it's actually pretty groovy when you think about it, because we're learning about human culture throughout the years. And even if you don't have an Egyptian heritage, it's still a human heritage. You need to realize it doesn't matter what our cultures are. This is the story of humanity, and it serves us well to know the history of the people who came before us. Does that make sense? I hope so. So the Book of the Dead, created for the ancient Egyptians, is one of the largest surviving complete rolls. Like we said earlier on, the discovered in the early 1900s, it was cut into 96 separate sheets to make it easier to study. This is the most complete one that we've had. Made it easier to study, to store, and actually to display for those that haven't seen one. You, like I said, I can't stress enough, you need to see one. They're really cool. Now it is sometimes known, like I said, as, if you want to look it up, the Greenfield Papyrus, after Edith May Greenfield, who donated the roll to the British History Museum. Now, the Egyptian goddess and goddesses, or gods and goddesses, mentioned in the books of the dead. We need to talk about this because nothing instilled more fear in tomb raiders in times of past than the possibility of encountering curses that warned of dire consequences for those that did not heed their warning. Can you think about that for a second? Like, I mean, how many people have seen like Raiders of the Lost Ark or the Tomb of the Mummy or whatever? In ancient Egypt, curses were sometimes placed on tomb entrances to protect the sacred monuments from being disturbed or looted. The inscriptions sometimes spoke of the deceased coming back to life to seek revenge, or called for judgment to be taken in the underworld. Anyone who ignored such warnings would do so at their own peril. Stories and rumors surrounding curses placed upon tombs and mummies have existed for centuries. There are records dating back to the medieval and early modern period stating that ancient Egyptian burial sites should not be tampered with because they and the mummies residing in them possessed unknown and seemingly evil qualities. Now, it was believed that curses were placed around burial sites by priests and priestesses in order to protect both the mummies and protect their spiritual journeys after death. These beliefs form the idea behind the so-called curses of the pharaohs, and anyone who entered or disturbed the tomb of a mummy, now particularly that of a pharaoh, would be subject to bad luck and inevitable death. The power of a curse as a deterrent depended upon its location. Though curses were not commonly recorded in the tombs of ancient Egypt, they were used on occasion for the protection of the burial place itself. Tomb curses would be inscribed in the tomb chapel, the more public part of the tomb complex, and also on the walls, false doors, stelae, statues, and sometimes the sarcophaguses or coffins themselves. Some of the more unusual curses included the donkey curse, which I would say is pretty hardcore if you wanted to curse somebody, because I don't know that I'd want to be wielding this around, but the donkey curse, which actually probably, if you guessed it, threatened the violator of the tomb by being raped by a donkey. So that would scare me. I wouldn't want to have that happen. The animal of Seth, by the way. Another complete curse comes from the administrator of the 18th dynasty, Amenhotep, son of Haku. He threatens anyone who would damage his tomb with a very lengthy list of punishments. This list is so lengthy, folks, that I decided that I wasn't going to list, and it's not out of disrespect that I don't list Amenhotep's curse list of curses. It's because it's so long that we'd probably need another 40 minutes to even talk about it and actually explain what they all really meant, because they're pretty hardcore. If you thought being raped by a donkey is a threat, they're worse than that. So now, like I said, this lengthy list, trust me, you don't want to be on the receiving end of any of the curses on this list. Now, legends surrounding the so-called curse of the pharaohs start around 7th century AD, when the Arabs conquered Egypt, could not read the hieroglyphics. By the way, they did not would not be deciphered until the beginning of the 19th century. The preservation of the mummies must have been a strange sight to behold. Now, many stories were told and believed that if one entered a tomb and uttered a magical formula or a magical spell, They would be able to materialize objects made invisible by the ancient Egyptians. Also, it was thought that through magic, mummies could become alive, living dead. They believed that the Egyptians would protect their tombs by magical means, wards, or curses on anyone who entered. Arab writers warned people not to tamper with the mummies or their tombs because they knew Egyptians project, blah, if I could talk, Egyptians actually practiced magic during the funeral ceremony. So it wasn't just prayers and lamentations, they were actually casting spells. Come on, you got to put fun in the funeral somewhere. Or the romance and necromancy. The first published book about an Egyptian curse was actually published in the year 1699, and hundreds were to follow, actually. Most of the Egyptian curses are metaphysical, but in some cases, actual. Booby traps and the use of poison did actually enforce these magic spells, causing injury or even death to those who trespassed. For example, tombs were sealed and bolted and contained secret chambers which were difficult to access. Passages were blocked with massive stone slabs. There were hidden holes, trap doors, and wires used as booby traps. Ancient Egyptian engineers would also cover the floors and walls of tombs with hematite powder, a sharp metallic dust designed to cause a slow and very painful death to those who inhaled enough of it, which was then released into the air when the stones would be disturbed. Now, when Egyptologist Dr. Zahi Hawass entered the Oasis tomb in 2001, his team actually found the sarcophagus booby-trapped within 8 inches of hematite powder, forcing them to abandon their expedition until they could come back with hazmat suits and respirators. While curses might seem to be the superstition of the ancients, there are many, many today who still arm themselves with objects or incantations of protection against the effects of curses. Now, scientific studies have revealed a powerful psychological phenomenon in which those who firmly believe that they are cursed eventually succumb to a physical ailment brought on by a strong stress response. In this way, perhaps curses from ancient times remain powerful to this very day. According to legend, the curse of the pharaohs will be cast on whoever disturbs the mummy or tomb of an ancient Egyptian. Now, the curse doesn't care if you're a serious-minded archaeologist or an opportunistic thief, and the spell is especially powerful if the mummy happens to be a pharaoh. Now, over the years, there have been numerous reported cases of cursed archaeological sites where excavators and tomb robbers began to experience strange sensations, sudden illnesses, and even death after coming in contact with a mummy or ancient Egyptian artifact. Curses were placed on tombs as safety measures. If the body, possessions, or burial place of the deceased was disturbed, then they wouldn't be guaranteed a peaceful afterlife. But those warnings didn't stop people from poking around in them. One of the most famous archaeologists who got cursed was Lord Carnarvon, who, along with Howard Carter, did what? That's right, discovered King Tut's tomb. His death was the first among many related to that site. Some people attribute these deaths to other more science-based reasons, but there are still a lot of eerie coincidences in these antidotes. Whether these curses really exist is besides the point, really, when you think about it, because there's lots of other heinous things that could happen to you. What's seriously fascinating me is that these curses created such frightening and compelling narratives that the public began to believe that beings could exact revenge from beyond the grave. Now, we discover more about cursed ancient Egyptian tombs and mummies and the poor sods who basically become victims of these curses. Now, we know a little about King Tut or Tutankhamun. When King Tutankhamun's tomb was found, journalists reported that the following inscription was near the door. And it reads, and I quote, "Death shall come on swift wings to him who disturbs the peace of the king." That's exactly what it says. In fact, there were several mysterious deaths surrounding the opening of King Tut's tomb. Some of us already know, but in case you don't know, we're going to talk about it some more. The first and most publicized death was that of Egyptologist Lord Carnarvon. He and Howard Carter were the ones to open King Tut's tomb. It was their idea to go out there and do that. Carnarvon died, and actually before this setup, let me back the train up for a second so that you guys know that they were told by people, they had a hard time getting people for their expeditions because they didn't want to get cursed. They didn't want bad things to happen to their family members. So they kept going around. These guys were like, well, I don't care about that. I want to know more about history. Well, I want to know about history too, but I don't know if I'm willing to get my head lopped off or breathe in hematite dust or have salt acid sprayed in my face. Sometimes you gotta weigh out the good for the bad, right? Now, knowing that he and Howard Carter were the ones to open King Tut's tomb, Carnarvon died a few months after the discovery from an infected mosquito bite on his cheek. The death had an eerie tie to Tut. When an autopsy was performed on the pharaoh's body, a similar lesion was found on his cheek. Also, when Lord Carnarvon died, all of the lights in his house were rumored to have suddenly blacked out with no explanation. Lord Carnarvon wasn't the only one to fall victim to Tut's curse. Howard Carter gave his friend Sir Bruce Ingham a paperweight made of a mummified hand because, you know, mummified hands are the gift that keeps on giving. I know that I wouldn't mind getting a mummified hand. I'm just saying. But back then, it was something that was truly macabre. And cue the lightning. I don't know if you guys can hear that. Are the pharaohs listening? Lightning and thunder. So, Sir Bruce Ingham got a paperweight made from a mummified hand with a bracelet with the following inscription. And these guys could read this hieratic, so they knew. They knew what it said. So it wasn't like they were not warned, okay? This is what it said, and I quote, "Cursed be he who moves my body. To him shall come fire, water, and pestilence." That's fairly serious. After Ingham received this gift, his house burned down. Once he had finally rebuilt it, his house was hit by a flood, a freak flood. Now, George J. Gould, Audrey Herbert, Hugh Evelyn White, Aaron Emmer and Archibald Douglas Reed are also said to be victims of the Curse of Tut, King Tutankhamun. Like Kanavaran, they all died shortly after coming into contact with Tut's mummy or artifacts within his tomb. Which I find really interesting that, and like when there's a story that goes that when Carter went to call Kanavaran to talk about some of the other finds that they found when they got to another chamber, another breakthrough chamber, because Kanavaran had actually left the dig site, that in the background there could be heard a ruckus because Kanavaran's canary was actually being eaten by an asp. That an asp had gotten in, climbed up the cage, and was eating the canary while they were talking on the phone. Creepy coincidence or Curse of the Pharaohs? What do you think? In my book, 101 still equal 2. And if something keeps coming up sounding the same, and you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's not always a platypus. So there you go. So we're going to go move on and talk about the unlucky mummy, which actually wasn't a mummy at all. It was actually a piece of a board that was actually of an unidentified woman that actually came from a coffin or another. Well, we're just going to say coffin because it was a board. It could have been part of a larger piece of a casket, but I'm thinking it probably was the interior part of a smaller coffin. This mummy board actually is currently housed at the British Museum in London, but rumor had it, it got around in its day. Apparently, during its early time at the museum, the staff would hear loud banging coming from the artifact. And one man took a photograph of the mummy board and it was horrified by the image that appeared once he had developed the photograph itself. The eerie events continued until a museum guard died of suspicious circumstances. Believing that his coffin was cursed, the museum wanted to get rid of it as quickly as possible, so it was sold to an American archaeologist. He took that mummy board with him on an American-bound ship. Wait for it. That American-bound ship was the Titanic. Yes, that Titanic. Some people speculate that the presence of this cursed mummy board caused the sinking of the Titanic, which is a really interesting thing to think about because this board had its mishaps prior to it being sold off to the person that it got received by and then later ended up on the manifest of the Titanic. Now, where is the board now? Did it sink with the Titanic or was it recovered? Because the British Museum says that they still have it. So was it on the Titanic? I don't know. But that it makes it for an interesting story, doesn't it? And moving on into 1971, during an excavation in Saqqara, Egyptologist Walter Brian Emery found a small statue of the Egyptian god of death, Osiris. At the end of the day, he and his assistant turned to the dig site's office in a nearby village. Emery took the statue of Osiris with him. Once at the office, Emery went to the restroom, as you do, have to go to the restroom at your office. After a few moments, his assistant began to hear Emery screaming. He ran to the man and found him clutching the sink's basin, clearly experiencing some kind of trauma. His assistant said that Emery stood there as if paralyzed. I grabbed him by the shoulders and dragged him onto the couch. Then I ran to the telephone. Emery was diagnosed with paralysis of the right side of his body and was unable to speak. He died the following day, not even 24 hours later. Now, in 2004, a man visiting Egypt reportedly stole a relic from the Valley of the Kings, which is, in case you didn't know, where King Tut's tomb once resided. Well, his tomb resides there, but a lot of the stuff has been taken, brought back, taken, spread around. Some stuff has been brought back, but largely it's on display. When he returned home to Germany, this man, he was overcome with a fever, which progressed into a very strange paralysis, and the man shortly died after. His stepson was convinced that the artifact was cursed, and that he decided to return the relic to Egypt's Supreme Council for Antiquities in the hopes that his father's soul would rest in peace. In 1972, King Tut's curse seemingly returned with a vengeance. Some of the artifacts from King Tut's tomb were sent to the British Museum to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the tomb's discovery. Dr. Gamal Meres, the director of the antiquities at the museum in Cairo, died the night after he handled the artifacts that were to be sent to England. But the curse did not stop there. Many of the airmen who were aboard the aircraft that was carrying the artifacts to England also fell victim as well. Three of the men on the aircraft suffered from heart attacks or strokes after coming into contact with these artifacts. One of the men had a heart attack at the same time every year, the same day he flew aboard the plane with King Tut's relics, until one of the days, one of the heart attacks actually killed him. Now, another incident was actually written in 1699 by Louis Pasteur. He wrote of a mummy's curse in his book, A Treatise on Embalming. I'd say it in French, but not everybody's going to want that. He recounted basically the story of a Polish man who had purchased two mummies from Alexandria. Now, for those that don't know, when before we started pilfering all these things and finding multitudes upon multitudes of mummified bodies, they were actually using the mummified bodies to fuel trains. I'm not kidding. They were using them to stoke the fires in the coals instead of just using coal fire. It was coal fire and mummies. Interesting? Yeah. So it must be some interesting paranormal stories from that. But this Polish man who purchased two mummies from Alexandria, presumably to study them for medical purposes, we're hoping, as he was sailing home across the Mediterranean Sea, as we all do, we purchase mummies and we put them on boats, he began to be haunted by two ghosts who suddenly appeared on his boat. The man acted quickly, throwing the mummies overboard. His visions of these spectral apparitions of the mummies stopped as soon as the bodies were swallowed by the open sea. Coincidence? I don't know. What do you think? But just so that you know, curses are actually not limited to just mummies and their artifacts. They're actually now finding other things here. As I found in my research recently, Israeli antiquities authorities And archaeologists have discovered a 1700-year-old cursed tablet in the ruins of an old Roman mansion in the city of David in Jerusalem. It is believed that the words were written by a magician, and it outlines a curse placed on a man by a woman, probably over a legal case, like a legal squabble. The text on the tablet is actually written in Greek, and in it, a woman named Caleria invokes the six names of gods to cast a spell on a man named Lenes. Part of the curse reads, and I quote, "I strike and strike down and nail down the tongue, the eyes, the wrath, the ire, the anger, the procrastination, the opposition of Lenes," end quote. Carilla then asked the gods to ensure that he, Lenes, in no way oppose, so that he say or perform nothing averse to Carilla, but rather that Lenes, whom the womb bore, be subject to her, which means that he will do whatever she says, basically. What is most surprising about the curse is that it basically combines elements from four different regions of six gods invoked. Now, four of them are Greek: Hermes, Persephone, Pluto, and Hecate. One is Babylonia, but Babylonian, Ereshkigal, and one Abstarax is Gnostic, a religion basically connected to early Christianity, in case you don't know. Additionally, the text contains magic words such as Laoth that have Hebrew Judaism origins. Now, early to nearly 2,000 cursed tablets now have been found throughout the world, throughout the whole world, cursed tablets. Mostly written in Greek, they have been found particularly in Greece, Italy, England, Egypt, and Middle Eastern countries. The tablets are typically created using very thin sheets of lead, which were scratched with tiny letters, then often rolled, folded, or pierced with nails. These bound tablets were then usually placed beneath the ground, either buried in graves or tombs, thrown into wells or pools, sequestered in underground sanctuaries, or nailed to the walls of temples. Many of these cursed tablets that were discovered at Athens refer to court cases and curse the opposing litigant, asking that he botch his performance in court, forgetting his words, becoming dizzy, and so on and so forth. Others include erotic binding spells, spells ranged against thieves and businesses and sporting rivals. About 130 curse tablets have been found in the town of Bath, England, where many of the curses related to the thefts of clothing while the victim was bathing. Why would you want to steal somebody's clothes? I just don't understand. Still don't get that. People do that to this day. That's why I don't leave when I'm doing my laundry if I have to do it with the laundry mat. People are weird. Yeah. But in ancient Egypt, so-called execration texts appear around the time of the 12th dynasty, listing the names of enemies written on clay figurines or pottery, which were then smashed and buried beneath a building under construction or in a cemetery. So that if that isn't spell work, I don't know what is. What do you think? I think so. Because why would you not? And so, what I wanted to do here, even though we're rounding out our hour here, because I got a little bit late here, so I was going to talk about some of the gods and goddesses and how they pertain to the Egyptian Book of the Dead or the Books of the Dead. And because it's important that we understand how they actually work and the inner workings of the Book of the Dead to know more of how these curses and spells and things all work together, because these guys all work together. And like I said, it's mind-blowing how much of this now I'm going to start with Nu represents the primeval watery mass from which all the gods actually evolve, and all of these people and places and things are actually mentioned in the Book of the Dead, in the Books of the Dead. Just to clarify. So Nu representing the primeval watery mass from which all the gods evolved, and upon which floats the bark of millions of years containing the sun. The gods' chief titles are Father of the Gods and Begetter of the Great Company of Gods. He is depicted in the form of a seated deity having upon his head a disc and plumes, like giant ostrich plumes or peacock feathers, things like that. Now, Nut, the female principle of Nu, she is depicted with the head of a snake surmounted by a disc or with the head of a cat. Now, Ta is also associated with the god Khnemu in carrying out certain creation and the mandates of Thoth, the divine intelligence. His name remains the opener, and he was identified by the Greeks and by the Latins with Vulcan. So he was worshipped at a very early date in Memphis, which actually is called in Egyptian texts the House of Ka and Ta. And according to Herodotus, his temple there was founded by Mena or Menes. He is called the exceedingly great god in the beginning of the being, and the father of fathers, and the power of powers, and is in his created form. Now, Khnemu worked with Ta in carrying out the work of creation ordered by Thoth, and there's more than one Thoth, so just so that you know, and is therefore one of the oldest divinities in Egyptian history. His name means to mold or to model. His connection with the primeval water caused him to be regarded as the chief god of inundation and lord of the cataract and the Elephantine. He dwelt in Anu, but he was lord of Elephantine and the builder of men, the maker of the gods, and the father from the beginning. Kythera was a form of the rising sun and was both a type of matter, which is on the point of passing from inertness into life, and also out of a dead body, which is about to burst forth into a new life or new afterlife in a glorified form. He's depicted in the form of a man having a beetle for a head, and this insect was also his type and an emblem among the ancient nations because it was believed to be self-begotten and self-produced. So to this notion, we owe the myriads of beetles or scarabs, which are actually found in Egyptian tombs of all ages and in Egypt, and also on some of the Greek islands and settlements around the Mediterranean, Phoenicia and Syria, and also a little where elsewhere. The seat of the god of Kephira was on the boat of the sun, which the boat of the sun has got to be pretty GD gigantor because there's a lot of gods that sail around on this boat. Tum or Timu, the closer, there's always got to be a closer of the deal, right? Was the great god of Anu and the head of the great company of the gods of that place. It would seem that he usurped the position of Ra in Egyptian mythology, or at any rate, the priests of Anu, succeeding in causing their local god either to separately or joined with Ra to be accepted as the leader of the divine group. He's represented as the evening or the night sun. And As such, he's called the 15th chapter, or he's called out in the 15th chapter of the Book of the Dead, called the Divine God, the Self-Creator and created, maker of the gods, creator of men who stretched out the heavens, the lightener of the Tuat with his two eyes, etc. The cool breezes of the north wind for which every man or for every deceased man prayed. We were supposed to proceed from him. He is, as pointed out, always depicted in the form of an actual man. He wears crowns and holds them, both the scepter and emblem of life. On a mummy case at Turin, he's actually depicted in the boat of the sun, in the company of the god Cythera. Between them are the beetle and the sun's disk. Now, in later times, the Egyptian called the feminine form of Timu, Tempt. Ra. Ra was the name given to the sun by Egyptians in a remote antiquity. But the meaning of the word or the attribute which they ascribed for the sun by it is actually unknown. Ra was the invisible emblem of God, big G God, and was regarded as the god of this earth, to whom offerings and sacrifices were to be made daily. And when he appeared above the horizon at the creation, time began. In the pyramid text of the soul of the deceased makes its way to where Ra is in heaven, and Ra is entreated to give it a place in the bark of millions of years, wherein he sails over the sky. The Egyptians attributed to the sun a morning and an evening boat, and in these the god sat accompanied by Kephira and Timu, his own forms in the morning and the evening respectively, and in his daily course he vanquished night and darkness, and mist and cloud disappeared from before his rays. Subsequently, basically, the Egyptians invented the moral conception of the sun, representing the victory of right over wrong, or good over evil, and of truth and falsehood, or truth or lies. From a natural point of view, and the sun being synonymous with movement and basically typified the life of a man from dawn to dusk, and the setting of the one typified the death of the other. Usually, Ra is depicted in human form, sometimes with the head of a hawk, and sometimes without. Shu, the second member of this company of the gods, Anu, was the firstborn son of Ra Tmu, or Tum, by the goddess Hathor, the sky, and was the twin brother of Tefnut. He is the light. He lifted up the sky, Nut from the earth, Seb, and placed it upon the steps which were in Khemenu. Say that 10 times fast. He is usually depicted in the form of a man who wears upon his head feathers upon feathers and holds his hand a giant scepter. In other times, he appears in the form of a man with upraised arms with nothing in his hands. On his head, he has the emblem for which he is often accompanied by the four pillars of heaven, or the heavens. Among the many amulets which are found in the tombs are two which have reference to Shu, the little models of the steps upon which Shu rested, the sky in Khemenu, and the crouching figure of a god supporting the sun's disk, symbolizing the act of raising the sun's disk into space between the sky and the earth at the time when he separated Nut from Seb. Now, Tefnut, the third member of the company of the gods of Anu, was the daughter of Ra Timu or Timu, and the twin sister of Shu. She represented in one form moisture, which I hate that word, and in another aspect, she seems to basically personify the power of sunlight itself. She's depicted in the form of a woman, usually with the head of a lioness surmounted by a disc or some kind of medallion. However, the twin brother and sister each have a lion's head. In the pyramid text, they also play kind of a very strange part, Shu being supposed to carry away hunger from the deceased and Tefnut his thirst. Now Seb, the fourth member of the company of the gods Anu, was the son of Shu, husband of Nut, if we're keeping track of all of this, and by her father Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys. Originally, he was the god of the earth and is called both the father of the gods and the Arpa, basically the tribal hereditary head of the gods. He is depicted in human form, sometimes with a crown on his head and a scepter, and in his right hand, sometimes he has a goose, which for some reason the goose is very sacred to him. There's a story there, but you don't want it. It's pretty lengthy. In many places, he's called the Great Cackler, and he's supposed to have laid an egg from which the world sprang. So already in the pyramid text, he's become a god of the dead by virtue of representing the earth wherein the deceased was laid. So god of the earth. Now, Ausar or Osiris, the sixth member of the company of the gods of Anu, was the son of Seb and Nut, and the husband of his sister Isis, the father of Horus, the son of Isis, and the brother of Set and Nephthys. The version of his sufferings and death by Plutarch has been already described, as we talked about before. Whatever may have been the foundation of this legend is pretty certain that his character as a god of the dead was well defined long before the versions of pyramid texts were known to us or were written. And the only important change to which took place in the views of the Egyptians concerning him in later days was the ascription to him and the attributes which in early dynasties were actually regarded as belonging to only Ra or Ra-Tmu. Originally, Osiris was a form of the sun god, and speaking generally, he may have said to have been represented the sun after it had set. Not set, but after the sun set. And as such was the emblem of the motionless dead. Later, texts identify him with the moon. The Egyptians asserted that he was the father of the gods who had given him birth. And as he was the god of both yesterday and of today, he became the type of eternal existence and the symbol for immortality. As such, he took not only the attributes of Ra, but those of every other god, and at length he was both the god of the dead and the god of the living. As judge of the dead, he was believed to exercise functions similar to those attributed to God. Alone among many of the gods of Egypt, Osiris was chosen as the type of what the deceased had hoped to become when his body, having been mummified in the prescribed way that we described earlier today, and ceremonies proper to the occasion having been performed, and the prayers and spells said, his glorified body should enter into his presence in heaven. To him as Lord of Eternity, by which title as Judge of the Dead, he was commonly addressed. The deceased appealed to make his flesh to germinate and to save his body from decay. Interesting? Yeah. Now, Aset or Isis, whichever you decide, I speak of her as Isis. The seventh member of the company of the gods of Anu was the wife of Osiris and the mother of Horus. Her woes have been described by both Egyptian and Greek writers. Her commonest names are the great goddess, the divine mother, the mistress of charms and enchantments. In later times, she's called the mother of the gods and the living one. She's usually depicted in the form of a woman with a head dress in the shape of a seat, the hieroglyphic for which forms her name. The animal sacred to her was the cow, hence she sometimes actually wears upon her head the horns of that animal, accompanied by large plumes of feathers. In another aspect, she's identified with the goddess Selk or Serk. She is then has upon her head a scorpion. So you have all these multiple dualities, right? So another aspect, she's united to the star Suathis. So when the star is added to her crown, she is, however, most commonly represented, if I could talk today, most commonly represented as the mother suckling her child Horus, and the figures of her in this aspect in bronze exist in the thousands. As a nature goddess, she is seen standing in the boat of the sun, and she was probably the deity of the dawn. Now, Horus, or Heru, the sun god, was originally totally distinct god from Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis. But from the earliest times, it seems that the two gods were confounded and that the attributes of one were ascribed to the other, which made it so confusing. The fight which Horus, the sun god, waged against night and darkness was also at a very early period identified with the combat between Horus, the son of Isis, and his brother Set. The visible emblem of the sun god was at a very early date, the hawk. The hawk is which was probably the first living thing worshipped by the early Egyptians, already in the pyramid text. The hawk on a standard is used indiscriminately to represent the word God. The principal forms of Horus, the sun god, which probably represents the sun at various periods of the day and night, Horus the Great, Horus of the Two Eyes, of the Sun, of the Moon, Heru, the Golden Horus, Heru-Netkat-Anma, Horus dwelling in blindness, or Heru-Khuti, Horus of the Two Horizons, the type of which on Earth was the Sphinx, Horus the Uniter of the North and South, Horus of Heqen, Horus of Behutet, the Sippi of Horus, which became so common at a late period in Egypt, it seemed to unite the idea of physical and moral conceptions of Horus, the sun god, and of Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis. So Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, appears in Egyptian texts, usually as Heru Khepkhart, which there's a P in the middle that you're, yeah, whatever. Horus, the child, who afterwards became the avenger of his father, Osiris, and occupied his throne, as we are told in many places in the Book of the Dead. Now, Set, or Sutekh, the eighth member of the company of the gods of Anu, was a son of Seben Nut and at the hus and the husband of his sister. Nephthys was the wor the worship of this god is exceedingly old, and in the pyramid text, we actually find that he's more often mentioned with Horus and the other gods of the Heliopolitan company in terms of reverence. So we're basically top 10 here. He was also believed to perform friendly offices for the deceased and to be a god of Serket Aru, or abode of the blessed dead. He is usually depicted in human form with a head of an animal, which has not yet been identified. In later times, the head of basically a jackass was confounded with it. But then the figures of the god in bronze, which are preserved at the British Museum and elsewhere, prove to beyond a doubt that the head of Set is that of an animal that is really unknown to us. It looks kind of like a jackass, but we're not sure. In the early dynasties, he was a benevolent god and one whose favor was sought after by the living and by the dead. And so, in the late 14th dynasty, kings delighted to call themselves beloved of Set. So, about the 22nd dynasty, however, it became the fashion to regard the god as the origin of all evil, and his statues and images were so of effectually destroyed that only a few actually escaped by accident have come out to us so that we could actually have seen them in all their full glory. So originally, Set or Sut represented the natural night, and he was the opposite of Horus. That Horus and Set were the opposite aspects or forms of the same god, proven by the figure given where we see the head of Set and the head of Horus upon one body, the duality again, as you can see. The natural opposition of the day and the night was at the early period confounded with the battle which took place between Horus, the son of Isis, and Set, wherein Isis intervened, and it seemed that the moral idea of the battle between, excuse me, the battle of right against wrong or good against evil became attached to the latter. Combat, which was undertaken by Horus to avenge his father's murder by Set. Now, the last one I'm going to mention here in passing, we've got several more, but I don't want to cut into somebody else's time here. But we do have Nebhet or Nephthys, the last member of the company of the gods of Anu, was the daughter of Sebennut and the sister of Osiris and Isis, and the sister of the wife Set. Now, when the sun arose at the creation of the primeval waters, Nephthys occupied a place in his boat with Isis and the other deities. As a nature goddess, she either represents the day before sunrise or after sunset. See, there's male and female dualities, but no portion of the night. So sunrise, both sets of twilight, but not night itself. She's depicted in the form of a woman having upon her head the hieroglyphics which form her actual name, Lady of the House. A legend preserved by Plutarch makes her the mother of Apnu or Anubis by Osiris. In Egyptian texts, Anpu is called the son of Ra. In religious texts, Nephthys is made to be the companion of Isis in all her troubles and grief for her brother's death. And that the death is great, and that is that of his wife. So where we go into Anpu or Anubis, the son of Osiris and Ra, sometimes by Isis and sometimes by Nephthys, seems to represent as a nature god either the darkest part of twilight or the earliest dawn, the duality again, as you see. He's depicted either in human form with a jackal's head or as a jackal himself. In the legend of Osiris and Isis, Anubis played a prominent part in the connection with the dead body of Osiris. And in the papyrus, we see him standing as guard and protector of the deceased lying and waiting for the judgment. In the judgment scene itself, he's found as the guard of the balance, the pointer of which he watches with great diligence. He became recognized the god of sepulchral chambers and eventually presided over the whole of the funeral mountain. He is always regarded as the messenger of Osiris. So on that, folks, I'm going to wrap up with talking about the curses and the books of the dead, which I could actually go on for an entire week about, I'm pretty sure. I've got enough here to go with that. And with that being said, I hope you guys have an amazing week. Don't forget to catch my show next with John DeSalvo on Paranormal X Hour for 1 hour right after me. And we'll be talking about whatever John wants to talk about today. We're probably something really cool and paranormal or something really cool and spiritual. And to catch my partner in crime, Lorelei Podfin's live show tonight at 9 p.m. Central, The Angel Rock. And then tomorrow, you'll find me here, Seraphine Hurley and Lorelei Podfin of The Angel Rock for Tripping the Void, which we'll both be doing tomorrow night. See on UPRN Talk Radio 107.7 New Orleans. You all have a fabulous evening, and I hope to catch you in the next few minutes for Paranormal X coming up next. Thank you.